We don't think of the harm and danger that certain forms of speech, both the actual speaking of hate, and then also the exclusion of voices and images that again create stories in people's heads about who's worthy, who's deserving. Of course, media bias and defamation, they do not pull the trigger, but they do help paint the target on our backs.
Activism and Power, a discussion with Makani Temba, who has raised more than $20 million for advocates working in communities of color, and more side eye at election 2016. All that and much more coming up next. And welcome to Thursday's Community Watch and Comment, the on-the-ground edition for November 12th, 2015 on WPFW 89.3 Jazz and Justice Radio in the nation's capital. On the ground and onthegroundshow.org are devoted to coverage of social justice activism on the streets and in the suites of power. I'm Esther Averam.
And I'm Chantal James.
Today we have a special show, an extended conversation with veteran activist and organizer Makani Temba, who is stepping down as executive director of the Praxis Project, which has raised more than $20 million for advocacy organizations working in communities of color nationwide. Now, 13 years after she founded Praxis, she is turning over the reins of the organization to the next generation of leadership. And Makani will be celebrated this Saturday night right here in the DMV at the Busboys and Poets Hyattsville location. And in our culture and media moment, Amy Alexander and Jamila Bey are here to give a side eye to this week's coverage of the U.S. presidential race. So as always, we have a lot for you in this less than an hour, including your calls in the second half. But we'll start with our headlines, topped by a rally of hundreds marching through D.C. this week. Right, Chantel?
Yes, Esther. Marching under the banner, Our Generation, Our Choice, hundreds of young people from across the country came together in D.C. on Monday for a mass action to demand justice on race, climate change, and immigration. Organizers said that the message of the action was a generational call to power to keep fossil fuels in the ground, protect the lives of black, brown, poor, and immigrant communities, to reinvest in healthy jobs, renewable energy, and an economy that works for everyone. The mass mobilization was organized by many groups, including 350.org, Million Hoodies, United We Dream, and the Fossil Fuel Divestment Student Network. Trenton Casillas Bankberg of the Lakota Nation spoke to the crowd at Franklin Square.
I'd like to give a big congratulations to all those across the nation who fought for the rejection of the Keystone XL pipeline. I'd also like to thank our president, Mr. Barack Obama, for signing the papers. Although there are other corporations trying to construct more oil pipelines, and the fight is not over yet, let's definitely look at this as an event to celebrate and look back on as a milestone of our success in defending the sacred land and water of our Mother Earth, Uchimaka! We are all young people mobilizing for the freedom to live and keep our families together on a sustainable, livable planet. And honestly, the political status quo is threatening the lives and futures of young people. And our political system is failing us, so we're taking these crises into our own hands. Where we come from, the Black Hills are the heart of our nation, the Lakota Nation. And there is fracking going on in the Black Hills for uranium. And that uranium is seeping into our waters, and we drink it every day. Not only uranium, we're drinking lead, we're drinking fluoride, we're drinking arsenic. Our water is polluted, and we need your help. Our people are suffering at home, and it's hard to watch. So we're not going to watch anymore. The people are awake now.
Attendees gathered in Franklin Square before marching through the streets of Washington, D.C. to the White House. Once there, street art was staged, including the painting of a large parachute. At the White House, the protest was also joined by a group protesting Benjamin Netanyahu's visit to the White House, swelling the crowd even more.
Now, some of the same activists and organizations out this week for Our Generation, Our Choice will be mobilizing for next week's Fall Rising action to oppose the Trans-Pacific Partnership Treaty that organizers say will offshore American jobs, expand global corporate rule, harm the planet, and destroy democracy. So beginning on Saturday, there are 5 days of activities against the TPP, but the main event is the Mass Action March for Trade Justice. And that's next Monday beginning at 4:30 p.m. at the Chamber of Commerce, 1615 8th Street in Northwest D.C. Also, yesterday was Veterans Day, 2015, 10 years after Lavina Johnson, an Army private serving in Iraq, was shot to death on an Army base in Iraq. The Army has continued to classify her death as a suicide, but her family and friends have continued the quest for justice in her death, saying that they uncovered evidence that she was raped, tortured, and murdered. You can get more information about Lavina Johnson's case by viewing her family's documentary, The Silent Truth, on YouTube. Petitions have also been created on change.org and on Color Lines. Yesterday, there was also a wreath-laying ceremony at the African American Civil War Museum and memorial to honor black soldiers who fought for their freedom. Now, Chantel, you also went to that ceremony, right?
Yes. The event was held outdoors at the memorial at Vermont Avenue and U Street, across from the museum. Frank Smith, executive director of the museum, explained the significance of the wreath-laying ceremony.
This monument is dedicated to 209,145 African-American soldiers and their officers who joined the Union Army to fight for their freedom. And so as we celebrate Veterans Day today, we not only celebrate our veterans who are in the field today out guarding us, we also celebrate those veterans who, at a time when this nation was in crisis, joined President Lincoln to save the nation, end slavery, and make America the free country that it is today.
After the ceremony, Frank Smith led a guided tour of the museum.
Thank you, Chantel. And kind of late-breaking news for our headlines, the Chesapeake Climate Action Network is urging the public to crowd the D.C. Public Service Commission meeting this Tuesday, November 17th, as the commission holds its one and only public hearing on Mayor Bowser's backroom deal with Exelon about their proposed takeover of Pepco. The commission is holding only one public hearing next Tuesday, November 17th at 10 a.m. at 1325 G Street Northwest, Suite 800 in Washington, D.C. People power stopped this merger once, and we can do it again with your help, says Mike Tidwell, director of the Chesapeake Climate Action Network. He says the facts show that Mayor Bowser's settlement deal does nothing to address the merger's core threats to ratepayers or our clean energy future. On top of that, he says, it increasingly stinks of scandal. Again, the one public hearing on Mayor Bowser's deal with Exelon will be next Tuesday, November 17th at 10 a.m. at 1325 G Street, Northwest D.C. in Suite 800. You can get more information at the Chesapeake Climate Action Network online. And those are our headlines. When we come back, we'll have our culture and media moment with Side Eye. Stay with us. Well, this is the section where we really talk about what the hell are y'all talking about?
what's beneath it all.
Right. Yeah. So I know that there are a lot of sports fans like me who are irked by the increased insertion of U.S. military and militarism into our favorite games and TV pastimes. You know, you're kicking back, you're taking a mental break at night or on the weekend, enjoying a basketball game, a football game, and then there's like a flyover of fighter jets. You know, the American flag covering the entire field, grown men, athletes doing stand-ups, thanking soldiers for keeping us free and safe, when it is common knowledge that our invasions in the Middle East are making us less safe. So it's all ridiculousness, but it's finally woven into the script and into what is unfolding before your eyes, this marriage between athletic competition and militarism and what is American. So the recent report that the Department of Defense spent $53 million on marketing and advertising contracts with sports teams between 2012 and 2015, nothing before that, right, should come as no surprise. But even hawks like John McCain are irked by a budget line for paid patriotism, meaning those on-field tributes like the NFL salute to service. So I just want to say that as a sports fan, I'd ban it all. Let me enjoy my games without trying to trick me into equating the clean fight of sport with the dirty fight of imperialist wars. So just stop telling everyone about how our volunteer army is fighting for our freedom. Okay, just stop, just stop, just stop, just stop. Okay, well, that's my rant, all right? But that's my rant for my sports. But let's turn to the sport of politics. It's time again for our weekly news, politics, and media segment, Side Eye on 2016. We're excited to have our two media and political analysts, Amy Alexander and Jamila Bay, providing unvarnished analysis of the fakery, hypocrisy, and general dumbidity of election 2016 coverage. It's been a busy week, Amy, so let's jump in. What earned major Side Eye from you this week?
Thank you, Esther. Yes, now we're within a year of the election, and so there's plenty that's going on, as you know, and obviously in the recent days, the biggest story, that everyone was focused on was the GOP debate, right? That was a major focus of political watchers, and it certainly was a source of much side eye. So, but in the interest of sanity, I homed in on what we will call hashtag social sickness, you know, because social media really has become an important aspect of political campaigns and coverage of them. So, you know, it's interesting if you think about the way social media has sort of, you know, begun to infiltrate and affect the way campaigns get perceived and are covered. And, you know, it's hard to believe it wasn't that long ago when political correspondents and journalists who cover campaigns actually were sort of respectful about candidates' positions, you know, whether you approve of that or not. That's sort of the way things were. But, you know, those days are gone, long gone, and social media seems to be a big part of the reason why. So, for example, I followed the GOP debate Tuesday night in addition to watching on TV. I followed in Twitter, and, you know, people were wilding in Twitter. You know, I'm a journalist by training and trade for many years, and I have all in my network filled with journalists, so I follow a lot of journalists. And, it's one thing to have Joe and Jane Public, right, who sit in their chairs at home in front of the TV and yell at the candidates or throw beer cans at the TV. But it's another thing to see sort of, you know, metaphorically the same kind of behavior going on in Twitter from journalists, right? So just above and beyond questioning the GOP candidates' positions, which, you know, let's face it, everybody on that stage Tuesday night, their positions are pretty dubious. But I mean, you have journalists in Twitter who ostensibly in their day jobs are paid to be objective, right? Mm-hmm. But there they are on Twitter straight up blasting the candidates, you know, everything from Governor Kasich, former Ohio Governor Kasich, combativeness, you know, to Rand Paul's sort of dude bro way of talking, to, in the case of Jeb, exclamation point, his low energy level, right? So everyone's in there on Twitter cracking wise. For example, there's Derek Thompson of The Atlantic, who's a really good thinker and writer, and he sent a tweet, you know, early on in the proceedings that read, here are things the GOP hopefuls want less of. Trump, wages generally. Carson, minimum wages. Rubio, philosophy majors. Cruz, locusts. Bush, sadness, you know. So you know, it's yeah, and it's all so you know, they're journalists, they're clearly Even on the conservative side, there were journalists who are also chiming in, although most of their bon mots were favorable, you know, which is pretty amazing. And in full disclosure, I have to say that I, too, was guilty of chiming in during the debate. It's hard to resist, you know. It's sort of like when back when you were in elementary school and, you know, one group of kids starts teaming up on another group of kids. You know it's wrong, but you just sort of go, you know, forgive them, Lord, they know not what they're doing, you know. It's sort of a mob mentality takes hold. So, you know, the spectacle of journalists snarking about presidential candidates and this instant analysis in real time, it's new in the annals of presidential elections. So it makes it, for me, it makes the facts only journalist within me, which is sort of my core, you know, of being a communicator for many years, it makes me kind of queasy. It really does. So, it, you know, that's my side eye, you know, the hashtag social sickness. I find it confusing and disappointing, but it shows no sign of abating. So, you know, I just have a sense that it's a dynamic that will not turn out well for the public and for the news industry. So that's my, that drew my biggest side eye this week. And Jamila, we want to know what you got.
Is Jamila with us? So I have to say, Amy, though, I mean, I'm kind of with the people who were being snarky, because the thing is, on the one hand, you don't want people to kind of do this instant analysis if they're just kind of objective journalists. Maybe they're going to have to cover this candidate. But on the other hand, you know, you do have other journalists. I read one piece online. I think she was a Daily Coast writer talking about how Ben Carson was actually saying, you know, they're treating me bad. They didn't treat Obama like this. I'm getting worse treatment than Obama got. And she was basically saying, excuse me, Mr. Carson, have you forgotten how Obama was treated during the election and how
even after
everything too. In his biographies was combed through with a fine-tooth comb? And
well,
so
the whole birther thing, show us your birth certificate, Trump is the king of that.
Exactly. And then also, I heard another really good point from a journalist about how even though Cruz and really looking into the Cuban background of Cruz and Rubio and how Rubio's kind of credentials are kind of questionable, and then Cruz is also and also their stance on immigration, when Cubans have this great exception in terms of immigration, they're the only ethnic group that gets to kind of come in automatically, no problem.
They have special status.
So how could you even speak a word about people who are outside of that special exception? So anyway, I think Jamila might be lurking on Skype now. Hi, Jamila.
Good morning, my friends. It's a lovely day.
Okay, so what do you have for us?
Well, this is a fine week for for our conversations to be happening here.
You got to speak up a little, Jamila. We want to hear you, all your fine words.
Mr. Trump this week came off being considered to have, you know, trumped his GOP opponents in the most recent debates. The thing is, the Don himself did not fare so well last Saturday night. In fact, despite all the protests that demanded that NBC not give Trump the reins to go ahead and be the host of SNL, he turned up anyhow. And I think sadder even than his unceremonious and epic bombing was perhaps his departure. Do we have some sad music for Mr. Trump's departure from SNL this week?
Yeah, we have a little sad music for him.
Thank you very much. What a great evening.
Now, here's the thing.
I'm not hearing you so well, Jamila.
At the end of every SNL, the cast, the music plays, the cast and the special guests spend time. Well, the Saturday night cast spent more time avoiding Donald Trump, the host, and hugging each other and fawning over Larry David, whose Bernie Sanders impression is still one of the funniest political impersonations we have seen that isn't Key, Peel, or Obama in this last term. The New York Post even wrote that it seemed that SNL is trying to sabotage Trump. But the thing is, you know who's actually likeliest, I think, to lose out here? I believe it's going to be the NBC stations who have been ordered by the Federal Communications Commission to offer equal time to the other 14 Republican presidential candidates.
Oh my God.
Yes. In an NBC memo, Trump was said to have, quote, appeared without charge for a total period of 12 minutes and 5 seconds. Since SNL is not a news program, stations now have to offer equal time. So potentially, NBC stations are going to have to give up 3 hours for the other candidates. But it's a limited time offer. The candidates only have 1 week to claim their spots. So, yeah. I mean, Amy, don't you, isn't this epic trolling at its best? I can't even be mad.
Yeah.
I think this election cycle and this candidate are doing a fine job of illustrating how the laws around airtime in particular need to be reconsidered. I mean, if Piyush Jindal, I can't call a grown man Bobby unless I grew up with him, but if Piyush Jindal of Louisiana and George Pataki out of New York wind up making quarter hour pitches to the national electorate on NBC for free, I think that's a scarier thing than Donald Trump in a barber chair at my corner shop.
Well, it'd be scary for Donald Trump.
Yeah.
All right.
That's good. Well, you know, that's something to consider, you know, and we'll have to see how this week plays out, if they're going to jump up and try to claim their time, the other Republican candidates, and if NBC will pony up.
Wow. I mean, so all the ratings they got for Donald Trump will surely plummet if, like, Bobby Jindal.
Right. right, you know, Well, that's interesting, and you know, that'll do it for us for now. We'll see what fresh hell the next week brings, and we'll see everyone back here next Thursday.
Indeed, we'll be watching.
Okay, well, thank you, Amy and Jamila. When we come back, making policy and making social change, our talk with Makani Temba. Stay with us.
Like a river flowing free through wind in the tea. Free to be sure of what I am and who I need not be. Free
All public broadcast stations receiving funds from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, or CPB, are required by law to have a Community Advisory Board, or CAB. The function of WPFW-CAB is to review the station's programming goals, the services provided by the station, and any significant policy decisions made by the station, and to serve as a vehicle for the community to effectively provide input to the local station board. To that end, the community is invited to offer feedback in any of these areas by emailing the CAB at cab.wpfw@mail.com. That's cab.wpfw@mail.com. WPFW, serving 100% of the 99.
And welcome back to Thursday's Community Watch and Comment, the on-the-ground edition. I'm Esther Rivera.
And I'm Chantel James.
Well, on this show, we've adopted the saying that we cover activism in the streets and in the suites. And in this next segment, we're going to talk about the balance of those worlds, the impact of protest and other types of organizational work in making policy and creating social change, and how those two acts are the same and sometimes different. With me to unpack these issues is veteran activist and organizer Makani Temba, founder and executive director of the Praxis Project, which has raised more than $20 million for advocacy organizations working in communities of color nationwide. Now, after 13 years, she's turning over the reins of the organization to the next generation of leadership, and Makani will be celebrated this Saturday night at the Busboys and Poets Hyattsville location. She's also a friend to many, including me, in full disclosure. So welcome to On the Ground, Makani.
I'm so glad to be here, and I'm just so grateful for the space that On the Ground creates. Thank you.
Oh, so let's dive right in, because we always say we have less than an hour, and we never have enough time for these deep discussions. So this is the thing. As the movement for Black Lives has blossomed around the country, and after the death of Michael Brown and the explosion in Ferguson, I'm wondering how the not-for-profit world is positioned within that. On this same show, I've had more than one activist tell me that our effort to change society cannot be funded by foundations that honor the pillars of capitalism. They say, but on the other hand, even they admit that it takes money and resources and paid organizers to maintain and build power if you're not going to just burn out. So what's the latest in this kind of ongoing conversation around how not-profits can support social change?
Well, you know, I think both are true. I believe, well, let's think about where those foundation money comes from, right? It comes from, for the most part, corporations that didn't pay people what they should have paid them in the first place. And so then they made a lot of money, and then now they have to give it away in some kind of way. So I have no problem trying to get that
money.
Right? I have no problem. That's our money. We earned it. We should get it. And I feel the same way about public money. A lot of people say, oh, man, you can't depend on the government. Well, that's true, but I still want them to pay for the things that we put our money in. We should have good schools, you know. Those are our tax dollars. So I believe that we have to fight for justice in philanthropy, justice around our public funding, and that, yes, the revolution will not be funded by Ford per se, but you know what? I'm going to get as much money as I can to make sure that folks have the money. And that I feel like that's important. Mm-hmm. And I feel like in many ways, that's what our institution has been about. But not just that. And then also helping people learn how to support each other. We have a long tradition as people of investing in ourselves, and that's important to hold up and expand. In fact, the truth of the matter is most of the money that funds the work that we do in our communities is from us putting money together, $5, $10 at a time.
Right.
And so I think it's important to understand that if you were to look at it as a pie, the money that we put in is much bigger than any foundation has ever put in. And that's how it's been for hundreds of years.
Yeah, so similarly, you know, many of the emerging movements have a anti-capitalist, anti-imperialist perspective. And is it possible to have that perspective within a nonprofit? I mean, I'm wondering if, you know, when it comes down to the fine lines, are you restricted in any way by addressing specific funded projects rather than kind of an overarching ideology about being anti-capitalist?
I think it depends on how you organize your organization. The C3 is really just a tax structure. It's mm-hmm. it's a structure that actually many of these activists are forming. You know,
right.
We're a fiscal agent for a lot of radical organizations that want to figure out how to get funding and also, you know, create new
maintain
structures.
Maintain right.
And I think that's really a challenge. What is the new structure? What is a revolutionary structure? We've been struggling with that for a long time. We thought it was a Vanguard Party. Some of that worked. Some of that, not so much.
And when you say that, what do you mean?
I mean that's a long conversation, but yeah. I think that many of us said, well, you know what, the most revolutionary structure that you can put together is a Vanguard Party. And there's things about Vanguard in terms of what's its relationship to regular people. Like, there's all kinds of things about that that we have to interrogate, that we have to understand. And I think it's the same thing with the nonprofit structure. Many of the folks who moved from those structures, especially the post-Communist Party structures in the 80s, you know, Line of March, Communist Workers' Party, they went and formed nonprofits. They ran for office. They tried to figure out how to use particular kinds of public and public but nonprofit structures for more radical work.
Right.
As folks experimented in the 60s, they experimented with Head Start. They fought for particular kinds of parent participation in Head Start to try to recreate Head Start as a radical institution that engaged parents and families in particular ways. People do that with schools. People have done that with hospitals.
Charter schools.
Charter schools, mm-hmm. all kinds of things. Mm-hmm. So we've been experimenting, and I think we're learning. And I think there's some things about the nonprofit structure that has its use, some things about the charter school structures that have its use, even though that's a little more problematic, too, in some ways. Well, not just shouldn't say more problematic. So we're trying to learn, and I think that the truth is that all of it has revolutionary potential, depending on how you step to it, how you think about it, how you create it. And then I even think that funding, we've made no bones about the kind of politics we have as an organization, but we still raise money. Mm-hmm. And I think that there are people out there who want to invest in a radical vision and who want it framed in a way that they can take it to their board and get the money, and we'll help you do that and have mm-hmm. no problem.
Okay. Well, speaking of some of your initiatives, I know a big one is the Communities Creating Healthy Environments, and this is an initiative of the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation to support public advocacy to advance healthy food outlets and safe places to play in our communities. And childhood obesity seems to be the core concern there. So when you look at something specific like that, it's specific, but it's such a complex issue. Do you feel like you were able to make a dent in something that is so ingrained in terms of culture and economics and neighborhoods?
Yeah, it's tough. I feel like what was important to us was not to look at it as a fat kid issue. This was not about childhood obesity, right? Mm-hmm. This was about the systems and structures that not only make our kids unhealthy, but make us all unhealthy.
Like so, food deserts. And,
well,
yeah.
I don't like to call them deserts just because they don't naturally occur, right?
You know, what do you call them?
They are deserted. They are communities deserted by the food industry is
right.
what they are.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we were able to do in partnership with the foundation was fund the fight. We were able to fund community organizing groups around the country on First Nations, in Black communities, in Latino communities, in Asian and Pacific Islander communities, and say, y'all know what a healthy community looks like. Y'all know that there's folks that you have to fight. There's industry to fight. There's public policy to fight in terms of the kind of food redlining that happens. And so we were able to support 22 groups around the country to really fight and also develop a vision in concert with folks on the ground to figure that out. So it's still a work in progress, but we were able to make a dent. We were able to create new outlets that folks fought for, and were able to establish co-ops, really developing another way of thinking about how folks are going to have access, and not just to food, but also to recreation and green space, which I felt like, which is just as important. Right.
Now, how does the green space and recreation, because usually that is involving like a public park or something like that. How, give me an example of.
Well,
of
some of it is the fight for parks, that. Right? Mm-hmm. And folks have established parks like in Harlem, the Greenway with, oh, goodness gracious, I can't believe I'm drawing a blank on the WEACT, West, West Harlem Environmental Action, fought really hard with other groups that were also supported to get that greenway in.
And you know,
there.
And I know, you fight for some green space in Harlem,
right.
Really, you know.
And
really.
It's also interesting because the other thing that's happening, which is part of the challenge, is you fight for a green space, and then by the time it happens, then it seems like gentrification happens all right around there. And then the folks who fought for it, that's happening in New Orleans and with grocery stores and markets, and this is a national phenomenon where people fight. They create these resources for these new kinds of businesses to come in that really serve the community, like a supermarket. And then what happens is they build condos over the market. That's in D.C. You go down to 5th and K.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
That Safeway is now sort of ensconced in
a condo land,
right, when it used to be projects down there. You know, back in the day. So it's, and what they do is the Safeway works with the city to basically put in a proposal based on what the community demographics used to be. and then they get all the breaks. But because the census is only every 5 years, in there's a 10-year census and there's a 5-year count, that they so they don't the demographic data doesn't catch up, so they're able to sort of pimp the demographics of the people who used to be there.
Right, right. This is serving a marginalized community or whatever.
Exactly.
So I know Chantel has a related question to the work.
Well, I wanted to ask you to break down some of the nonprofit world jargon for me. Those wonderful terms, they sound so smart, like cultural competency. What is it? How does that impact what Praxis does versus another organization?
Yeah, you know, I think, you know, everyone, well, one, you want to be competent. This is like the politically correct thing. It's like, I want to be correct, you know, I want to be correct and I want to be competent. Those are good things, right, to know what you're doing. You know, I think part of it is, and it's funny because, you know, your aunt wrote a book about this. Mm-hmm. I go something like, no, I'm kidding. it's that we have so much work that gets funded in the sector where essentially white organizations that have no connection to people of color at all are given money to do work in those communities. And oftentimes they screw it up because they have no sense of who folks are and what they do. You know, you see this in black communities, Latino communities, where they don't even speak the language. People are going in, doing work, don't even speak the language. And I always think of what Dr. Robert Ross, who's the head of the endowment, California Endowment, says, that if language didn't matter in health, then we'd all be veterinarians, right? You have to talk to people. So cultural competency is a way of saying you need to be competent about the kinds of cultures that you're working with. And that's not necessarily about ethnicity, but it is about culture. It's about if you're working with young people, what do you know about the kind of young people you're working with and what they think about and what they care about? Or are you just doing one size fits all? So that's one of them.
Wow. So we are going to go to a break. And, you know, we're in conversation with Makani Temba about activism and power. And when we return, you're welcome to join the discussion by calling 202-588-0893. And in the meantime, stay with us.
Does it gotta come down to this? In order to see things for what they are, for what it is. We still might not be free up in this piece or treated very equally as far as I can see. Hell no, we ain't all right.
Now all these press conferences, breaking news alert, this just in. While your government looks for a war to win. Flames for the blame game, names where I begin. Walls closing and get some help if I can. Who cares? By the rest of the Bush nation stares as the drama unfolds, as we the people under the stairs. 50% of this son of a Bush nation is like hating on Haiti and setting up assassinations. Ask Pat Robinson, quiz him.
Smells like terrorism.
Racism in the news, still one-sided views. Saying white's fine food. Pray for the National Guard who be ready to shoot, because they be saying us blacks loot.
What is your boy, son of a Bush, doing?
Nerd. New Orleans in the morning, afternoon, and night.
Hell no.
We ain't alright. New Orleans in the morning, afternoon, and night.
Hell no.
We ain't alright. New Orleans in the morning, afternoon, and night.
Hell no.
We ain't alright. In the morning, afternoon, and night.
Hell no!
Damn.
Now them fires, earthquakes, tsunamis, I don't mean to scare. Wasn't this written somewhere? Disgraces, all I be seeing is hurting black faces. Moved out to all them faraway places. Emergency state corpses, alligators, and snakes. Big difference between this haze and the diamonds of the BMAs. You better look what's really important, y'all, under the sun. Especially if you over 21. This ain't no TV show, ain't no video. This is really real. Beyond them same old, keep it real. Quotes from them TV stars driving big rim cars. Streets be flooding me. No matter where you at, no gas. Driving is a luxury of the sea. Don't y'all know? They said it's a state of emergency. Show somebody's government is far from reality.
Hey, yo, check 1, 2.
New Orleans in the morning, afternoon, and night.
Hell no.
We ain't alright. New Orleans in the morning, afternoon, and night.
Hell no.
We ain't alright.
We got a
New Orleans in the morning, afternoon, and night.
Hell no.
We ain't alright. New Orleans in the morning, afternoon, and night.
That was Public Enemy on Thursday's Community Watch and Comment, the On the Ground edition, onthegroundshow.org. I'm Esther Avaram.
And I'm Chantel James.
And we're in conversation with veteran activist and organizer Makani Temba, outgoing executive director of the Praxis Project, which has funded $20 million to social justice organizations. And you can join the discussion by calling 202-588-0893. I think I have two callers. Let me just go to them real quickly. Just say your first name and where you're calling from.
Hi, this is Ike. I'm calling from Baltimore.
Hi, Ike.
Now, can you dig it? It's my sister. I'm so glad to have y'all on here because somebody know what they talking about.
Okay, all right.
Hold it. Don't do this to me because I get emotional when I got women on the phone that's smart and I have an intellectual conversation. I want to say one thing. It's five things that we have to be concerned about our people in America, and it's economics, education, health, housing, and justice. Now, we as a people have to have a vision, a mission, an objective, and strategies. And you know what I'm talking about when it comes down to going to get that money and putting that money out there for people that's in need. Let's keep talking about these things. I want y'all intellectual sisters to talk about the five things. Economics, education, health, housing, and justice, and the other four things. Our vision, our mission, and our objectives and strategies. I'm getting off the phone. Love y'all.
Love you back. Well, so you know, he talked about something that made me think of a question I had about transforming communities, and I read something you wrote about the emphasis on the local, and I know that Jackson, Mississippi, was an important example to you of building that power, and so. Remind us of what examples existed there or exist there now that those of us around the country should study.
Yeah, and I think, well, yeah, there's Jackson, Mississippi, which especially under Mayor Chokwe Lumumba, who passed away almost 2 years, it'll be in February, was an amazing visionary, but he wasn't the only one. So there are still people on the ground in Jackson doing the work. There's a Just Transition for Jackson movement going on that's talking about how they're going to rebuild the economics, the health, the education. So Brother Ike, they're hearing you all the way down in Jackson. Mm-hmm. I want you to know. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of co-op development going on, work to rethink education. So folks are really trying to operate from a place of vision. And that Jackson is one place, of course. It's interesting because up in the far north New England, like the people's, you know, state of Vermont, you know, there's so much going on that we can learn from and been some really interesting experimentation. So there's interesting things happening all over the country. And the only last thing I want to say, too, that I want to let people know about is that every year we have a gathering called Roots and Remedies. And that gathering brings together about 300 activists and organizers from around the country to vision the future, where it's a vision lab, it's fun, it's 100 years in the future, where do we want to go? And so I want to invite people to sort of look it up on YouTube and online and see what the folks on the ground are thinking about and dreaming about.
Okay. And I know I have a couple people holding, so let me go to the next caller and then we'll get back to our discussion. Just say your first name and where you're calling from.
Good morning, my sisters. Tespa from Arlington.
Good morning, Tespa.
Good morning, my sisters. It is good to have people like you fighting for the people, and we can sense it. And it's good to hear your guests and you yourself, my sister, Asta. Let me say this. Look, details need to be attended because people in Baltimore, people in Southeast Washington, D.C., people in California, they all need some kind of change for their lives. Medicine, or a sick child, or a child from a poor family. All kinds of details. Details between the difference between Republicans and Democrats. The difference between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders. It means a whole lot. But if we peg our hope of freedom on American presidential elections, the bitter experience of Africans in Congo who have been massacred, you know, like a massacre of 6 million people, the people of Ethiopia under a genocidal government financed by the U.S. government under Bill Clinton, George Bush, and now Obama, and the Eritrean people suffering under the dictator installed by America, still supported by America, tells us we cannot attach our hope of freedom on American elections, and where and life and freedom are much more bigger than American presidency and American elections.
Okay. Thank you so much, Tesfa. I think you may be responding to our side eye when talking about the election and all these ridiculous things happening with that. You know, the speaking of the election, I know that the minimum wage, you know, the fight for 15 has become somewhat of an issue. And you said in an essay that I read that, you know, the war on poverty has turned into the war on the poor. So tell me from your vantage point and doing the work that you've done for the past more than a decade, you know, what are the main strategies to combat that war?
Wow, that's like a whole show. And
I know.
And I do, and that's all good. It's all good. I have to say, WPFW has like the best audience in the country. I just love the folk who call in. They like, they are the real deal. You got to love that. Mm-hmm. You know, this, I people can feel it, right? There's a whole range of things happening. Part of it is like just how high housing has become, that there's really no support for folks, the safety net. And it's bad enough to not have money and to be paid poorly and to have to work in places where you don't know from one day to the next what your shift is going to be. I mean,
right.
Just really crazy.
Exactly.
And have your rent going up and up and really no controls or support. And people who are, even who are tenants, afraid to fight for rent control because somehow they feel like they'll be a landlord one day and they want to be able to raise the rent. I actually hear that from people who have been renters for 30, 40 years say that to me. But given all of that, what has happened, I think, is that there's been folks who have created new kinds of communities where profit is not at the center. And that's really how we address this so-called, not so-called, this real war against the poor. We have to have housing that's stabilized, that does not allow speculation, you know, that this is housing for people to live, that's set within a particular percentage of their income, so, and it doesn't go up. And those kinds of housing units are really important. And that's not just affordable housing, which is usually not even that affordable, but that's housing for people with low income, or housing that's cooperative, where people work together to be able to live in the house so they have sweat equity. And there's more and more of that happening in Detroit, which is awesome, right? You see communities that are sweat equity based. And I think the access to quality food, people growing their own food in urban gardens and sharing and figuring those kinds of things. Because if food is only connected to profit, and the only way a community can get access to food is if a supermarket feels like you're the kind of community that they can make money off of, then that's how you get so-called food deserts, because it shouldn't just be about profit. People have to eat.
Right.
Regardless. And it shouldn't just be government cheese, which is also, you know, hard to come by, actually.
Right, right.
So
yeah.
A lot of the programs that that many of us grew up with, that's how we survived, those programs don't exist anymore, and I don't think we realize it, and that the government has really put everything on the nonprofit sector to handle all of this business, which really, this is what our money as taxpayers should be going to.
Right, instead of war.
Yeah, not war.
Yeah.
We should be feeding each other and caring for each other, building incredible schools so
and
that every single
exactly.
kid goes to school and does well.
Yeah, so even though I have real problems with Bernie Sanders' like foreign policy positions, which, you know, don't seem to be very different from Hillary Clinton's, I have to say that, you know, just hearing someone – step on the stage and talk about wealth inequality and talk about, I think he's the first presidential candidate I heard say the word institutional racism.
Yes.
You know, the fact that, I mean, you know, I take these like small victories, you know, too hard,
absolutely,
you know? And so even though he has a lot of work to do on his foreign policy, I do believe that, those positions and policies he's put forward are important. So I think I have another caller on the line. Just say your first name and where you're calling from.
Yes, my name is Michelle. I'm calling from Washington, D.C.
Thank you, Michelle, a woman calling. I just think so tired.
I am calling, first of all, to thank Makani and the Praxis Project for all of the outstanding work that they do for justice. The communities that we serve, Environmental Justice Health Alliance, Praxis has always been there, putting our announcements out there about making sure that we are protecting those who live fence line to some of these, the nation's most egregious toxic chemical facilities. In addition to that, this latest campaign we're working on with the Campaign for Healthier Solutions, right, and making sure that dollar stores that are proliferating our communities have healthy, sustainable foods and actually have an economic justice piece in that, where we are looking to reform. So, Makani, we just want to thank you for publicly for the outstanding work that you do on behalf of those who need it the most. You're always there for them. Praxis is always there for them. And for us as advocates, too, when even we're down, we want to say thank you and God bless you for the amazing work that you do and we know will continue to do.
Oh my goodness. I feel choked up.
Oh, thank you, my sister. And I have to say, this is Michelle Roberts, and folks in D.C. don't know her. She is a hero.
I think I met her on something with the dollar stores.
Awesome. She should be on the show, and she has definitely been fighting a long time, school toxics in D.C., all kinds of stuff. Just my hero, my shiro. Thank you so much for calling in. I just so appreciate you, love.
Yeah, we put on the air a piece about, I think, the dollar store. It was a study about dollar stores and how they are, like, selling people this toxic stuff. And I think I met her at the Venezuelan embassy. So, anyway, thank you, Michelle.
She needs to come on the show and talk more about
exactly.
it. Exactly. She's
so awesome. I'm running out of time, but let's do 3 30-second hits, okay? So, you talked about in your Transforming Communities program description, what are the building blocks of a new democracy? So give me 3 building blocks real quick.
Vision, I think people being together and sharing a vision, having control of the resources and making those decisions together, like participatory budgeting, and really having the opportunity to see each other as human beings so they know they can govern together and trust each other, because many of the laws we make are because we think other people are the other.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Robin Kelly, really quick. That's your brother, the historian, labor writer, thinker, Robin Kelly. How's he doing? Is he still in London?
No, he's in L.A., actually, probably as we speak, doing some child care and writing something wonderful.
And I know he credits you with teaching him how to read the last thing. It was like Hop on Pop, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. And so what's next for you? I know you moved to Detroit recently. You have a lot of things going on there, personally, professionally. So what's next for you?
You know, I don't know. But you know what? Folks can hit me and tell me what they think I ought to do, because I'm really trying to figure out what's next.
Okay. Well, thank you, Makani. That will have to do it for us on Thursday's Community Watch and Comment, the On the Ground edition. I'm Esther Avaram.
And I'm Chantal James.
And I'm also signing off for Amy and Jamila. Thanks to our guest again, Makani Temba. And thank you for supporting your station for Jazz and Justice. You can reach the show at the updated onthegroundshow.org website, where you can now listen to all of our shows and past shows. Please like our Facebook and Twitter pages at On the Ground Show. Now stay tuned for the news, followed by Krista Property on the Thursday edition of Don't Forget the Blues. Raise your voice out there. Peace.